Welcome to Eat, Sleep, Wine, Repeat, a podcast for all you wine lovers who, if you're like me, just cannot get enough of the good stuff. I'm Yanina Doyle, your host, brand ambassador, wine educator, and sommelier. So stick with me as we dive deeper into this ever-evolving, wonderful world of wine. And wherever you are listening to this, cheers to you. Hello, wine friends, and welcome back to another episode. So grab your passports because today we are heading over to Catalunya in Spain, and we will be guided by Rob Buckhaven. So many of you Londoners, maybe if you're reading the Metro, will know who Rob is. He is the drinks columnist for the Metro, and he's also released his own book called The Alcorithm. But we'll be getting to that in part two. So for this episode, part of Rob's history was as a brand ambassador for the very famous winery Torres. And so Torres has a stronghold in Catalonia with wines from Conca de Barbera, from Costas del Segre, but more famously known, Cava and Priorat. And these are the two main regions that we are going to be focusing on today. So we'll be discussing some of the new regulations and labelling terms that you should be looking out for, but also keeping in mind we're talking about Torres. Did you know that they have been focused on reviving pre-phylloxera Catalonian varieties? Well, get your pen and paper together, or just go to my show notes, download the transcript, and there you will find all of the grape varieties and how they're spelt, because we will be talking about several ones that you, I am sure, have never heard of. So pop open a bottle of Cava, you deserve it, and enjoy the episode. Tell me all about this harvest you did in South Africa, because this was the start of your whole love into wine, right?
Yeah, it was South Australia, actually. And it was my first foray into wine. I knew I wanted to get into wine because my mum used to read my sister and I Oz Clark's book while when we walked the dog. So I was like, I really want to get into wine. But at that stage, there was no clear path into it. So I remember I just reached out to loads of companies, and Adnams of all companies were trying to diversify from beer into wine.
Okay.
And so I worked with them, and they said, look, what you should do is you should do, you know, before you can even sell or market wine, you've got to know how it's made. So they said, look, here's some options. I think there was one in New Zealand, one in South Australia, and one in California, possibly. And I decided on South Australia. And so I reached out to them, and they said, yeah, come and do a harvest with us. So this was about sort of March time, you know, back in 2002 or 2003, I think. And so, yeah, so I did. So this was all self-funded. I was staying in a caravan on site of the winery.
Oh, my God, really? Did they provide you with the caravan?
No, I had to pay for that. So they paid me like a minimum wage while I was doing it. But so I got there, and I had to do everything from cleaning tanks to mixing up sort of tannin powder into water and putting it into the wines, into the vats. I had to, you know, tie up those wood chippings into big tea bags and put those into.
Oh my God. Okay. This is old fashioned South Australian winemaking.
It was really old fashioned. But the wines weren't even cheap. So I think Waitrose sold them. It was called Step Road Winery, and Waitrose sold them, and they were about sort of like 10, 11, 12 quid.
No,
they weren't exactly cheap, I know. So I was doing everything, you know, so I was there kind of dog's body. But it taught me about winemaking, not in the traditional sense, not in the kind of sense we'd know about today, but in kind of, as you say, old fashioned.
And I can't believe, funny enough, they were selling wine at that price, that Chardonnay that was so buttery and out of balance, that has basically made so many wine lovers around the whole world say, we're not, you know, ABC, anything but Chardonnay. How dare they? Everybody make a note of that winery.
And I was part of that problem.
You're the problem.
I'm the problem. Yeah. And then I complained about it when I was a journalist. You know, got into being a journalist, and I was like, I don't know what they think they're doing making these wines. And I was like, I was making those wines for them. You know, so it was my fault.
Yes, yeah. It's definitely a hands-on experience. I mean, were there any wine disasters then? Did you fall in any tanks?
Oh my goodness, worse than that. Worse than that. Yeah, and really? It's part of the thing of never try and kind of, never try and be proactively sort of helpful when you're doing these kind of things. Because I remember I just went, look, I'm going to clean the tops of the tanks. And I went up the catwalk to the top and I saw one of the tanks without a lid on. It was I thought, oh, I'm just going to put the lid on. I'm going to be really CO2? Helpful. I'm going to put the lid on, carried on sort of cleaning the rest of the tops of the tanks, came down sort of after about an hour and everyone was standing around their biggest tank in the winery. I think it held something like 90,000 litres or something. Uh-huh. And this was harvest time. So everyone was stressed and this tank had gone in on itself like a Coke can. So what they were doing was they were pumping wine out of the tank into another tank. Right. And so obviously when you do that, you don't want to, you know, lid on because you don't want it to suck its tank into itself. And I put the lid on. So as soon as it had finished with the wine, it then sucked the tank into itself like a Coke can. And it looked like a Coke can. You know, when you scrunch up a Coke can. And I went, oh my God, who did that? And they went, you did, you bloody pom. And I was like, oh God. So they forever named it the Pommy Tank and it's named after me. So,
That's so funny. Tedious. Well, they didn't get rid of you then.
I think that was quite near the end of my tenure there. So, I think they were pleased. Yeah. We after that, I think we had a party and all was forgiven, but they've named it the Pommy Tank. So I'm kind of weirdly honored.
Okay, cool. But any wineries listening, don't hire Rob.
Yeah. It's not my strong suit. Yeah. No. Like DIY practical things are not my strong suit. No.
And communications are a strong point. So I suppose coming back to England, it makes sense then actually becoming like a brand ambassador, which was for Torres, right?
So immediately when I came back, I did a number of other things. I worked with Bibendum. I worked with, you know, actually Bibendum Wine was my first ever job in the trade. And I first teamed up with them because I worked for Tesco. They were working with Tesco to evaluate the role of the wine advisor in store.
Uh-huh.
So I had to do a kind of 5-month thing there, then ended up working for Bibendum as a kind of salesperson. And then after that, I thought, look, I really want to get into marketing. So I had marketing in my mind and I thought, I really wanted to get into marketing. So what would give me an edge? And I'd seen somewhere that they were running in Bordeaux, a wine MBA. So wine MBA, which was a year-long course. And then by the end of it, you would become an MBA. So it included business, winemaking, everything. And I thought, plus, I want to be a student again. And so I signed up for it, got it, and stayed. So I lived in Bordeaux for a year. I studied. Our homework was to go and visit, you know, Chateau Pichon Longueville Baron and stuff, you know, and taste their wines. I know, it's terrible. And that sort of thing. So the end, and then you have to do a big thesis. And then I got an MBA from that. And then long story short, after that, I worked for Thierry's. And then I decided I wanted to be a classic brand manager. So saw the Torres job being advertised and went for that and got it. So I was Torres brand ambassador for 7.5 years.
Okay. That's a fair amount of time to get to know such a big company. So I imagine, though, you learn a lot from Torres.
Yeah, I think from Torres you do tend to, because it's a machine. It's a juggernaut. So in a way, you know, in a weird way, it's one of these things that's so big that it doesn't really need someone to look after it. Because they are so prescriptive in terms of, you know, what they need from this market, what they need from this market. So you really have no creative input into it whatsoever. So you're essentially an account manager. So you are managing the account, you're managing the budget. So it taught me about budget management. It taught me about sort of, you know, the way they marketed themselves, the way, you know, new product development, they'd sort of announce to us, here's a product, you've got to sell it. So it was all about this kind of thing. And so, you know, that you do learn a lot from a company just by looking at it and seeing how they operate. I mean, they operate in 150 different markets. So they are massive.
Yeah.
One of the key things I learned from them actually was the fact that they have a huge range. I think it's over 50 SKUs. But they are known as a supermarket brand because of Vinasol and Sangre de Toro. A lot of time and effort was put into actually trying to change the opinion of sommeliers to say, look, there's only two wines or three at a push because Esmeralda, yeah, but the rest is all to do with the restaurants and, you know, the hospitality. But yet, you know, people had it in their minds. They were saying, no, it's a supermarket brand. I'm not going to, you know, and in tastings, they'd almost pass by your stand. They go, oh, no, I know Torres. And you go, but hang on, we've got Mastellaplana. We've got, you know, we've got all these other ones. So it was an eye-opening one. They know what they want from each market. They know who they want to represent them in each market. You feel under scrutiny from them at all times. You know, yeah, and it's one of those companies that they have people to micromanage you at all times. So they're, you know, it was a bit like you were under the spotlight. But, you know, something like this, the pressure is character building and it leads you on to other things that you want to do.
Well, the people on the board, they have big dreams. Hence why they're also in Chile. And I mean, actually, do you remember the volume or the actual quantity of wines even coming out of, say, Spain division, ignoring Chile?
My goodness. I mean, it was just millions. Yeah. Millions and millions of bottles. I mean, it was just millions. And this was sort of, I finished working with them about 10 years ago. So I looked after Chile, their Sonoma and their spirits as well. So they've got spirits, they've got brandies, they were going into the Pisco market as well. What I did love about them were that they were pioneers in trying to kind of bring back to life those forgotten varieties in Spain, mm-hmm, rather than, you know, and you'd have thought for such a big company, they would, you know, they would do what's easy and go for the international varieties, but they were the opposite of that. If you look at Vinasol, it's 100% Parellada, which is one of the three Carver grapes. So for a wine that popular to be such an obscure grape that probably people can't even pronounce if they knew it, but they don't care. It's so rare because usually it's the grape you lead on, you know?
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
But I think, you know, I love the way they were really sort of at that point focusing on Chirello and Parellada. So as still wines rather than in Carver, I think only latterly they went into Carver.
To be honest, I love Chirello as a still wine variety. And I mean, obviously in the Carver component of which it's most famous, it gives that lovely high acidity. But on its own, the earthy, the herbal vibes. I mean, some people call it rubber, or I think I've even heard people call Chirello boiled cabbage. Which is unfair, it's totally unfair. But obviously it is giving that idea. These are not beautifully aromatic perfume aromas coming out of Chirello, but it's a really cool grape variety. And I think more and more winemakers are going for that 100% Chirello, which is exciting. It's great, right?
Super exciting. And sort of moving forward to my journalist hat on, I remember going to Gio Carver. Well, it was Penedès, obviously, but the Carver, you know, looking at the Carver houses there and actually looking to see many of them were working on at that point. And it was quite a new thing, but still Chirellos. And Chirello was really the hero grape out of all three, out of Parellada, Macabeo. That was the hero grape that they really want to push. And you can see why, because it does have that lovely acidity, which is why it works so well in Carver.
Yes. Yeah.
But equally, you know, it can take some oak aging, you know, a little bit. You don't want to overwhelm it. But it's, for me, it's got this kind of almost waxy. It's almost like when you wax a lemon. Mm-hmm. It's like that kind of waxy lemon. And I just love that. It's got texture to it as well. I think there's real promise for it.
Agreed. And even like a lovely, like a ginger note. I did a video a long, long time ago on YouTube. There you go. Plug, everyone. I haven't done a video on YouTube for like, I don't know how many years, but there's some old videos of a wine. It was Chirello, although they called it Panza Blanca. To confuse us all. But in a DO.
They always need those.
Yes. Because it's not confusing enough. But a DO just by Barcelona called Aleja, and it's actually really close to Barcelona. Yeah. And they really love working with Panza Blanca or Chirello. And so I was talking about this and ginger tones, lemon pith. We both vote for it, right?
So, so good. It's Panza Blanca in the north. And then Premsal Blanc in the island of Mallorca. So it's got all of these different synonyms and pseudonyms. It's like, it's to me, it's like Tempranillo, which has got over 100 pseudonyms. And you just think, well, oh, come on.
Well, okay, you know. Question. So obviously Tempranillo grows in the Catalunya region.
Yeah.
Typically, they're calling it Ull de Llebre. The Llebre, right? Yeah.
The Eye of the Hare. But another thing is, I love the way it's not a hero grape in that region. You know, it's not. You know, you've got the likes, and we're coming onto it later, of Priorat, and, you know, all these amazing regions, which are very much focusing on, there is some international varieties that obviously is Ull de Llebre, and there's also Garnacha, Carignana, you know, which are really the heroes of that region.
Well, absolutely. So you've mentioned a few. So let's actually, I think during your time working at Torres, they make wines in, obviously, Penedès. Mm. They make wines also in lesser known regions, which I want to touch on because you've obviously been there. So you've been to Costas del Segre and the Conca de Barbera. Like, what are they like to go and visit?
So we came back about 10 years. And I remember when I did go and visit Torres, we would obviously go and see some of the other regions within the area. We didn't spend as much time there as we did in Priorat. But what I did glean from these areas is, you know, you've got this rusticity to them. Torres, you could always bank on the fact that they had these beautiful wineries there. So, for example, in Conca de Barbera, they had Milmanda Castle. So that was just beautiful, this kind of, you know, ancient castle, the ruins of a castle. And, you know, I just think the region itself, and it's like, it reminded me of Priorat in the fact that it is so remote, like super remote. Within the, in the middle of it, you'll find these little villages, but it's just so remote. And particularly Priorat is so sort of rugged and dramatic and almost operatic in terms of landscape. It's just rocky. You just feel that you're the only person there. It is so silent. It's just, I found it some of the most striking scenery. And I, you know, I've been to quite a few of these wineries in these regions. And I thought that Penedès is just has such a beauty to it, a magnificence and a kind of drama to it that you don't really find in many other places like that. Mm-hmm. You know, you know, Priorat, going to Priorat, I was just thinking, it's got that obviously very particular slate. So it's got that Liquorella slate, which is kind of gray, but then in the sun, it's got this reddy tint because of the, you know, and it's shine, it sparkles in the light because of this mica within it.
Yeah.
And you can literally, you pick it up and you can snap it. It's totally brittle. And you feel like, and I always say this to people, you feel like you're on Mars. You know, it is so remote. You know, the echo, you know, if you shout or even speak, you've got the echo. You can't see anything for miles. And you just feel like you're the only person there. And it is just absolutely stunning. It's extraordinary.
Well, see, now, interesting, and it's fine because we're allowed to jump about. There's no rules on this podcast.
Yeah.
You've brought it down, well, I should say up the steep hills of Priorat. So actually, ignoring the lesser-known regions like Costas del Segre, was Priorat, is that the favourite place for you then?
Yeah.
Because it sounds like it.
Yeah, I think so. I think out of all the places I've visited, and there are, you know, they've all got their own merits, you know, and we'll come on to some of them later. But I just found Priorat, you know, somewhere that, and I haven't been for a while, but I just found it had this magic to it. It's got this magic. And I do find that, you know, it's got this kind of almost sort of volcanic looking, you know, slate. And I do find that that seeps into the wine. There's something spiritual about them. And I know, you know, Priorat, a lot of that is to do with the monks, is to do with the Carthusian monasteries, is to do with those ruins. But, and that, you know, it's almost auto-suggestion for me because it creeps into this kind of, makes the wines quite mystical to me.
Yeah.
You know, they've got a smokiness that you really don't find anywhere else in that way. A kind of, and it's probably because it sounds like it, but this kind of licorice note coming through and, you know, the whole mystique of the area, I could just go back to over and again. It's just stunning.
Oh, I love that. So again, I love Priorat. In fact, tasting, I haven't been. And you love the place, the wines. So this is one of the most premium wine regions of the whole of Spain. Yet wine appreciators don't often, it's often overlooked. Why is that?
I just think it's a lack of communication. It's like anything. It's like, you know, when people don't know about it, it's difficult. It's the best kept secret, you know, in fact. Mm. I just find they want to, you know, I've been sort of reading it up since, and it's an area that is under so much development and so much, you know, they are really sort of modernizing themselves in a way, because I think the wines used to be known as quite sort of big sort of wines, and now they are modernizing them. They're sort of taking back the use of oak a little bit, making it a bit more sensible, sensitive. They are, you know, there's less kind of extraction of fruit. So I think the wines themselves are becoming much more within people's palates. It's like the modern palate, what people want. They want a bit, mm-hmm. they want fruit, but they don't want too much, because otherwise they were just being, you know, seen as these cute, it's almost like the wines of Cahors lost out to Argentina, because Argentina took that grape and made it much more sort of palate friendly. And I think with Priorat, you know, and it ties in with what they're doing in terms of the sustainability, they're making their vineyards organic. They're taking back, they're almost leaving Mother Nature to do as much as she can. So the wines are much more natural. And I think now is the time to kind of communicate, whereas before, I'm not sure it would have fitted in with the palate of the people, you know, the general palate. I just love it. I just think, you know, you have these old vine Garnacha and Carignana on these kind of terraces, because it is such a almost hostile place to grow grapes in a way, mm-hmm. if you think about it. You know, these arid summers that reach over 40 degrees. And what they've got going for them as well is the diurnal temperatures are so different that you do get this lovely acidity coming along. Obviously, Carignana can put up with these arid conditions much more than Garnacha. So Garnacha is higher up. It's typically sort of planted higher up in these terraces, so can reach up to 900 meters. So it's really impressive. Weirdly enough, it's not, you know, if you think about 900 meters, yes, it's a lot, but it's not, you know, compared to some others, it's not that tall. But actually, yeah.
Not compared to South America.
Not compared to South America. But I think it's the fact that it is so hilly and just so dramatic. It reminded me of the Douro. It really did.
Okay.
And it, you know, so steep that you almost have to abseil down them to harvest. And obviously it's very low yielding. So what you do get is really concentrated fruit. So I think they need to almost temper that to fit in with what people like. So in answer to your question, I think it's the communication one. And I think the wines are quite a, you know, they're not to everyone's palate. I think they're becoming much more like that. And I think now, having sort of read up on it more, it's weirdly the whites that people are seeing more promise with for Priorat, which I never kind of appreciated before. I think it's, you know, with Garnacha Blanca, with all these, you know, with Trepat, with all these other, you know, grapes. And I just think that's really exciting.
If Priorat can get its name out there to become more household known, if it has to be on the whites because they're delicious as well. And Garnacha Blanca, I adore. In fact, actually, gosh, at some point I should just do a podcast on the white varieties of Spain, because Viura is incredible. We all kind of know about Albariño now, but, you know, it just, anyway, but that's a whole other podcast. So you said you think that in Priorat they're modernizing and maybe now is the time. Well, what do you think about this whole noms de la terra? So the name of the land, I guess, is what it translates to. So they're trying to, I guess, copy the Burgundy system with village names, single sites, Premier Crus and Grand Crus, right? What do you think of that?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, that came in, I think it was 2020. Whatever the case was, I hadn't been, I think it was about 5 years after I left working with Torres. So it came sort of well after that. You know what, with anything like this, and I know we're going to get on to talk about sort of Cava, you know, what they're doing there, but I think anything that brings in a sense of typicity of that area, and I think with the noms, although I'm not overly familiar with it, I do think what they're trying to do there, and I know it was spearheaded by Torres, which doesn't surprise me. And I think they're just trying to, they're almost trying to get to sort of hone in even more on kind of that particular area, that particular, what is that particular area and microclimate and soil, what does that do to that wine? It really gives it that really focused sense of place. And I think that's what, you know, I think they've got to be careful not to go overboard, because I think for people, it's like Cava, which has now become quite complex in the way systematically. And I think in a way people are like, whoa, this is a lot. So I think at the top end, which this is, I think it's great for collectors, for people who are particularly interested in Priorat. that's great.
Yeah.
I think for the average person, it's probably like, what is that? You know, kind of thing.
Absolutely. And I suppose even the names of what they're calling, yeah, people might get very confused. Like the village wine, a Vida. It's like, what does that mean? Yeah. For anybody really interested, knowing there are these tiers, they can look them up. And like you said, Torres, it's no surprise that Torres pushed this to happen, because there's only three Grand Cru sites and they have one of them. So it makes sense. But actually, like you said, for a collector, if somebody's listening to this saying, actually, do you know what? I want to know Priorat a little bit more. And then, you know, you can Google who are the best wineries in Priorat. But you can actually look now and be like, well, who's got the Grand Cru sites and who's, I think there's,
absolutely,
I can't remember how many Premier Cru sites are, but you could look at those two and then you're going to be like, cool, well, actually I'll buy those wines to sell her. So it, at least there is a little bit more of a system to make it easier to, what do you purchase if you want something super premium or age worthy?
Absolutely. I completely agree. And I like the fact that they're using Catalan names to actually name the system, you know, rather than make it international. Even more confusing for the consumer, possibly.
Yeah, I'm like, so, I can't pronounce any of it, but, you know, whatever.
Yeah, no, it's stop true. Making they, new they levels that I can't pronounce.
But anyway, for everyone to know, village wine, like single site wine, Premier Cru, Grand Cru, and then they have their old vines as well, which is amazing. And you can fit into, I think, all the different levels. But if you have old vines over 75 years, then they can on the label put Vieille Vin. And actually that's really cool.
Yes. That really makes sense. And it actually rewards people who are doing that.
Yeah.
You know, actually does give them that kind of, okay, that echelon that they need. You know, to promote their wine. So no, I'm all for that. You know, that's another thing about Torres that I really liked. You know, I loved the fact that they were constantly, and it goes towards sustainability as well. They're so pioneering in so many ways, you know, and never really stand still. You know, they are always the one to galvanize everyone up. And looking at sustainability, which we're, you know, for a second, because it all ties in. You know, what I love about Spain, and actually weirdly, so I mentioned jumping back that I did my MBA. My thesis was Spanish wine in the UK market.
Okay.
So convenient. That's what I convenient. So that's what I specialized in. And I remember I gave it, you know, during my interview with Torres, I gave them this really thick, it must have been, I can't remember how many, that like 20,000 word thesis. And I gave them it. And I was like, have a read of that. That tells you everything, you know, you need to know about my opinions about Spanish wine. And I remember in my thesis just being so amazed by, A, Spain has pretty much more surface area than anywhere else to you know, to grow grapes. They've got so many different microclimates, so many different regions, so many different indigenous grapes. So obviously that all helps. But what I love is that these regions are coming together. Mm. There's a real unity with Spain that I find, and a real collaboration between, obviously there is competitiveness, but there's actually more that unites them than anything else. So that's what I love about them. And if you think about it, I think now, certainly in 2021, they had more organic vineyards than anywhere else in the world. So I think a quarter of their vineyards were organic. And I think that must be even more now. So I think they're still leading the way, and looking at what they were doing in those Cava producers were doing. I mean, that their system they've got in place is now, I mean, you know, Vinyas de Garda, you know, the Paraje system, all of this, great, very difficult to understand for the consumer.
Again,
but really good. So I think there's a middle ground for all this.
Well,
I think it's...
No, totally. And it's interesting that you touched on the organics, because in the DO Cava, and part of this whole new system that they're trying to put in place, which is to showcase the quality, it's to give a certain amount of control so people really know what they're getting. But they have said that every producer in Cava will be organic by 2025.
It's so punchy. Yeah. I think that's fantastic. I just think it's hugely punchy. So what I love, Dio Penedès has come together, and I think that's their mantra. They want all vineyards to be fully organic by 2025, which doesn't leave them a lot of time. But, you know, if you think about it, Spain, much more than many other countries, is naturally quite an eco-friendly country for, you know, for winemaking and grape growing. And it's only sort of latterly, I think, when the sort of they wanted to modernize the way they did things, which actually then would use up more energy in winemaking practices, etc. So they're almost pulling it back to what they used to be anyway. Yeah. So they're not, they're only having to go, actually, let's just, it's almost like what's old is new. It's that thing with anything. And again, with Spain, it's the same thing. They're going, let's get back to how we used to be, which is pretty eco-friendly.
I agree. And it's nice, like you said, it helps to have a big body like Torres doing their climate change and teaming up with Jackson Family Wines, but it kind of shouting and screaming and putting that noise out there, which is always going to also keep everyone in Spain going, actually, yeah, what more can we do? As well, yeah. I assume. Yeah. I mean, so now going back to Carver, because I find this really, really interesting about with their new system. That's really confusing.
Oh my goodness.
It doesn't matter. And Rioja's done the same thing. But for anyone who decides, for instance, no, I really like sparkling wines and I want to have great, I suppose this is the, I mean, I don't know what your opinion is. I think this came out after some of the producers of Carver had had enough and moved away and created the Corpinat brand, where they said, hey, vines are going to be this old. It's going to be from your own vineyards. The wine is going to be made this way. And I think so now Carver said, okay, fine. This is our structure. And what's nice about it, actually, if anyone sees Superior on the label now, that it already is organic, it has to be. Yeah. So there's all of those ones already are. But they've gone more into the regions because actually Carver is not a place that, you know, of course we both know Penedès is the heart, but you don't know if you're drinking a Carver from Rioja or a Carver from
Extremadura. I think it's 90% or it might be slightly higher now is from Penedès, but you're right. Yeah. There are six places around Spain that can actually, you can legally make Carver. So it's funny because it's not like Prosecco, it's not like champagne because it's not from one particular area. Mm-hmm. You know, Carver just means, you know, cellar. It's not from an area, you know, it's just because I interviewed Javier Pagas for the drinks business. Okay. So he is obviously the head of Dio Carver and lovely, lovely guy. It was 2 years ago, is it 2 or 3 years ago? They completely changed the way their system and they made it much more complicated because I think it was sort of a backlash from having been viewed as cheap and cheerful, that kind of thing. They wanted to make themselves much more quality driven, basically, mm-hmm. and much more traceability, a massive point, which I think is great. And I asked Javier, I said, look, do you think you went overboard? Because it's quite, you know, you have all these different tiers and layers and things have been changed as in reservers and grand reservers. And he said, look, he was really candid actually and said, and it's all in the piece that I wrote. And he said, look, I think it's definitely when you're trying to galvanize this many producers, there's confusion as to deadlines, there's confusion as to what's required from them, that kind of thing. But I think we're headed in the right direction. I said, would you take it back at this stage? And he said, no. I think he said, any decision like that to change things so radically wouldn't happen overnight. So you really have to think about it. So I'm not about to take it back. I think it just needs time to bed itself in. And I think it's really working because people really want to be part of this. Yeah, they want to sort of, I just think he's done so well. But I do think for the consumer, one of my questions to him was, what are you doing to communicate it to the consumer, the end consumer? Because at the end of the day, that's what really matters.
And
he said, look, he said, that's a tricky one. Yeah, that is a tricky one because he said, and he was really candid. He said, he said, at the end of the day, there's some consumers who don't care. Who will never care. All they want is to know is, does that Carver go with this food? But there are others who actually want to know, probably the younger generation. I would say that, Gen Z, if you look at them, they're much more about provenance and traceability and wanting to know from field to glass, etc. And I said, so what are you doing? What practical steps? And he said things like, teaming up with Jose Pizarro, doing evenings like that in the UK. Yeah. Lovely. So having these select kind of chef ambassadors, because obviously, it goes so well with food. And I think they actually did some research with a flavor scientist and the flavor scientist picked Carver as the wine worldwide that went the best with food. It was the best. It had the best flavor components to go with food. So I think they're really sort of playing on that, which is great. And I just, he's doing things like, and I think they've had one already last year, bringing influencers over to there and educators and content creators and getting them to shout about it. That's almost what Priorat needs to do as well.
Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, it's like at the moment, part of these, you know, we know that 90-95% of kava is produced in the Penedès region. And so now they've broken up the, they've created these, I think, five zones. And Comtat de Barcelona is basically where most of this kava is coming from. But when people start seeing that on the label, or they decide to investigate and see what the other places are, this could be quite interesting. Because if somebody said to me, what does a kava taste like from Penedès compared to a kava from Rioja, I don't know. I've never had the opportunity to taste specifically kavas from those places. You would have to have investigated online where each kava is from before to try and figure it out. Absolutely. Whereas now, if you're interested, you can actually look on the label and see those regions, which is the next step for people getting to know, you know, terroir affects wines all over the world. Why would it not do that in kava?
No, I completely agree. Completely agree with you. And I just, you know, you mentioned Corpinat as well. That was one of the questions I asked Javier. And I said, are you trying to reel them back in, you know, with this new sort of qualification system?
The producers that left.
And, you know, there was no animosity there, which I thought was amazing. You know, he just
none
said,
that
look.
None that they're willing to admit.
No, but he was very transparent, you know. And what I loved about him, he had such a paternal sort of take on it. He just went, look, it's like your children, you know, if they have the money to do it themselves and they want to go, you know, break off and do their own thing, all power to them. He said, what I'm keen not to have is confusion from the outside world on the quality. And I think that was the key. It was, we do not want confusion as to what kava is and what it stands for and what the quality levels are based on these people who've done, you know, gone off and done their own thing. So effectively, he was saying, as long as they keep the quality up and it's all sort of basically tied in with what we're doing, we're fine. We're fine with it. I mean, obviously, he'd like them to come back into the fold, but I loved that kind of quite magnanimous way of looking at it. He was kind of like, well, you know, let them do their own thing. And if they've got it, they've got it. But let's just keep the quality up. Because he mentioned areas like, you know, regions like Rioja, like Chianti, like these different sort of areas that are known for their quality. And he said, we need to have that too.
Yeah.
So I thought that was really telling.
Well, everybody who's listening, kava is not just cheap plonk. And actually, you know, when people are having their vintage champagne that needs to be aged for at least 3 years, you know, you have that category now. You just need to look for the cava de pareja clasificada. Is it clasificada? Yeah.
Calificada.
Oh, calificada. Yeah, exactly. I can speak Spanish.
You can. But it's also like, but I love it because pareja literally means place. Yeah. So it's like, and guarda, the vinos de guarda. Guarda means to keep, you know, they've raised the, so for example, it's a minimum of 9 months aging. So that's very similar to champagne. Yeah. So cava de guarda superior. So the minimum reserve aging has gone up from 15 months to 18 months. So that was part of the what they put in. And then a 30 months for gran reserva. So it's pretty punchy in terms of gran reserva. And then you have cava de paraje calificada. So yeah, I just, you know, and in terms of the superior, there's a ceiling on production levels as well, which I think, you know, because they were going crazy with production. That was part of the problem for cava, because they were just churning out all of this cava that was being sold at these ridiculous prices and the quality just wasn't as it should be. So I think this one, you know, we probably won't be able to tell for a few years whether it's actually working, you know.
But it definitely keeps the wine makers, the vine growers focused at the very least.
Absolutely.
So I think that Spain, it's so interesting when we talk about the Catalunya region with cava, which so much is going on. Priorat, they're really trying to hone in on showcasing their quality.
Yeah.
But also, like we did mention, Torres is like trying to work with these pre-phylloxera vines and creating wines. So there's actually so much interesting stuff in this northeast corner of Spain, considering it's a region that people don't necessarily go to. But if people are not going to it, it allows them to be modern, to innovate, to change, to be exciting, right? And evolve.
Completely. And you're right. And I think it's that thing of the ancestral varieties that you were talking about. And even when, you know, while I was there, so one of their wines, which is one of their top-end wines, is Grans Morales. And you go there, so that's Conca de Barbera. And they have these, it's called Grans Morales, which are these big walls. So it's all part of these sort of post, these ancient walls that were there as a kind of medieval fortress. And you can still see them in the vines there. Uh-huh. Within that blend, they have things like Perol, which is... Which is basically, so an exclusively female vine, which is... Because they're usually hermaphrodites, these grapes. So this is exclusively female. The wines are really big and concentrated. I remember I had a tasting. They only had a tiny bit of it because they have these nursery vineyards that they actually grow them on, and had a tiny bit. And I just remember it being super concentrated, quite inky, sort of dark, high acidity, and sort of very fresh as well. So a great freshness. And that was one of them that was in their blend in a small sort of proportion. Mm-hmm. The other one was Garo. And then they had Samso, which is just another word for Carignan or Carignana, is another because it needs more. The other one they're working on is, and I don't know how to pronounce this properly, Gonfaus.
Gonfaus? Oh my God. Gonfaus. Okay. Yeah. Sure. Don't ask me.
So this was discovered, and part of what Miguel and his team were doing was he was sending out notes to local farmers, you know, not just farmers, the people, you know, the local people of Catalonia, to see, you know, I think he was putting adverts in various sort of papers and things saying, look, if you find a vine in your garden, in your field that you can't identify, send it into our lab and we will try and identify it and just see if it's one of these phylloxera resistant or ancestral vines. And this is the way they brought quite a few of them in, by other people saying, I found this one, what do you think? Mm. So it was mad, it's crazy. So Gonfaus is discovered in 1998 in the village of San Eulalia de Puig Oriol. And it's named after a field in the village. So the grapes are now grown in the heart of Leda. Again, this is another female variety. So some of these are sort of female, rather than being hermaphrodites, are just female varieties, which is crazy. So in the heart of Costa del Segre, these grow. The other one is Mono.
I mean, the thing is, they're so ancestral. Hardly anyone has them. You can't really ask, how do you pronounce it, right? You know, I guess.
No one knows. Probably not even they do.
Interpretation.
But I know with a couple of them. So there's a couple of them that Dio Penedès are really focusing on, bringing them back to life, but not just in a kind of tokenistic way of like, we'll put some in the blend, but actually bringing them back to life. Because there's a couple of those that are really kind of naturally resistant to climate change. And so obviously, you know, are able to store water better. So they have naturally better ways of coping with climate change than some of the others, which I think is brilliant. I think it's great. So they're using it in the fight against climate change to naturally help them out. So
that's fascinating. Yeah. Anyone who's interested, I mean, you can go on to Torres's website and they have the Forcada, which is actually they've made that into a single variety where they make a few hundred bottles that you can actually buy.
You can actually buy it. I think that's one of the only white grapes they have, Forcada.
I love that. I'm glad you said it was a white because I don't even know. And then Pyrene or Pyrenee. Is that a white grape?
Pyrenee, I don't know. I don't know that one. Pyrene, yeah. I don't even know how you pronounce it.
Of course not. But these are actual grapes as well that they have made as a single varietal that you can actually, that you can buy. So it's exciting, right?
Exciting. Yeah, I think a lot of them they use as kind of library stock as well, because you think about it, such small quantities. But Pyrene grows on the estate at Tremp in the foothills of Pyrenees. And again, I think Pyrene is one that is kind of slightly resistant to climate change. The other one is Sumol.
Sumol. I've heard of Sumol. I've heard of Sumol.
I feel
like that's in more places. I don't know.
So Sumol... So high quality, but again, resistant to climate change issues. That's all I know about it, you know, to be honest, Simon. Well. But, you know, watch this space. But it's the sort of thing, you're right, that if you do, no matter how little, you just see the name, you can just Google it and just start researching it and then hopefully get to try it.
I love it. Yeah. That's perfect. I love it.
Yeah.
Part two with Rob continues next week, and I am really picking his brains about what it's like to be a drinks columnist and a writer for the Metro. He travels to many places around the world, so he'll be sharing his discoveries, wine trends, wine stories, and we will be discussing that book, The Alcarhythm. So if you like one grape variety, you should probably like another. So I will be looking at certain grapes and asking Rob why he suggested another. So you'll be learning about different flavors and hopefully learning maybe about a grape variety you haven't tried before. Now, as you know, my incredible sponsor for this season is Wickham's Wine. You can go to their site, put the code in EATSLEEP10 and get yourself 10% off your first order. Their website is in my show notes, so you can click direct from there. And if you haven't already poured that glass of cava that I very subtly suggested, I've checked out online and Wickham's Wine has an interesting Blanc de Noir from Garnacha. So this is a white sparkling cava made from the red grape Garnacha, and it's a Brut Nature, which means no sugar added at all. So that could be a very interesting one for you to try. Now, if I wanted a quote for champagne, I could find hundreds online, but cava, not so many. But thankfully, one of the biggest producers of cava, Freshney, has come to save the day with a lovely simple quote, which I quite agree with. And they said, "There is only one thing better than a glass of cava, a bottle." So get yourself that bottle of cava. You know what's happening next week. Until then, wine friends, cheers to you.